The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
The amount of people looking for Andy Moore around Positano, it was all the rage. They're asking about what he's going to do next. When's the next episode out? The Football Pod's gone international.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
Off the ball. This is News Talk.
Now, you're very welcome back. So we mentioned there in the news round that Premier League and Championship clubs will be able to offer licensed standing areas from January 1st as part of a pilot programme. Very happy to say Tony Evans joins us from the London Independent, amongst other places. Hiya, Tony.
Hiya, how's things?
Yeah, very well. So this has been coming for some time, really. I know there was a trial before COVID. Research was carried out. There were various mechanisms trialled. Rail seating, in particular, was the trial at Celtic Park and Borussia Dortmund as well, and Shrewsbury Town and Wickham and Oxford. They trial these railings. Effectively, seats are folded away. There's a railing in front, a railing behind, and that all seemed to go very well. And it's probably there's been a campaign certainly for many a year now to bring this back into English football.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, one of the things, the biggest cause of resistance really was this idea that standing had caused the deaths of Hillsborough, which is so far from the truth, it's untrue. And almost, it was an emotional response by a lot of people, and many of them in Liverpool, and many of them, the families of those who died, the 97 who died, who basically said, we don't want standing back at any price. But it became clear that rail seating and safe standing were much more safe in a football ground than standing in seats. I mean, we've all seen it when someone scores and in, you know, sort of packed seats, people go tumbling down. Essentially, you've got a 2-foot tripwire in front of you. And this made it dangerous because people will always stand at football matches. And what we needed to do was to get them to stand in the safest possible way. And I think this has finally come to fruition. And it's, you know, more than three decades too late, but at least we've got there.
It has always been very emotive post Hillsborough, and wasn't it the Taylor report which pretty much installed that blanket ban, and that's been in place. So can you give us your sense, and I guess it's probably anecdotal as much as anything, that softening on Merseyside, when you think that started? Because I can imagine post Hillsborough, those immediate years in the 90s, there must have been a very strong sense, as you said, of like absolutely standing never again. That has to, you know, we don't want that to happen. When did you detect that softening in a very significant way, Tony?
Well, not until recently. 10 years ago, I went with a Football Supporters Federation Safe Standing Roadshow to Liverpool and got a relatively hostile reaction. And obviously, I stood up, faced them down and said, I was there. You know, I know what caused it, and stressed that one of the fundamental lies, and until we address that fundamental lie that stands and kill people, we weren't going to get the full extent of the culpability for the people who actually did it across to, you know, most of the public. And I think in the years since then, I think there's been a realization that safe standings work so well on the continent. You know, these trials have gone slowly, but they've built confidence. And I think increasingly, I think even those who have still have a little bit of a knee-jerk response to the idea of a standing, because, you know, it evokes so many painful memories. I think the realization for them has now come to the point that, yeah, this is the safest way to keep people from injuring themselves at football matches.
That reluctance is very understandable, one, because of the memories, and secondly, because the direct reaction to Hillsborough was to ban standing. So, you know, that neural pathway there, it's fairly well burned in.
Yeah, I mean, let's face it, part of the whole response to it was to throw the blame first the fans, and secondly it's standing. And what that did is it let those who actually caused it and endangered people, it let them off the hook. I mean, you know, the idea that the Leopards Lane wouldn't have a safety certificate and would host the semi-final is absolutely insane. And, you know, The bad design obviously put people in trouble, but, you know, the calamitous policing actually, you know, sort of caused people to die. I think when everyone looks at this, you see it's completely different. Every individual gets their own spech. Every individual is protected by a barrier in front and behind, and it really does create a space and a safe space for people who are standing up, watching football games. unfortunately, those who think it'll lead to cheaper ticket prices are wrong. They'll be exactly the same, and it won't increase attendances either.
So, yeah, capacity won't increase. Effectively, you'll just be standing where your seat is.
Yeah, yeah, you'll be paying to stand up rather than getting a seat you can relax in. So it's but as many people would prefer to stand at football games, I think it's the best way. Unfortunately, I can't see anything making going to games cheaper.
If there have been injuries with the celebrations in Premier League grounds of late, I suspect they've all been fairly minor. But you do see fans, as you said, tumbling down on top of each other and going crazy when there is a big goal. So I guess the railing stopped that happening in short.
Yeah, I mean, I was at for the UEFA Cup game at Old Trafford a few years ago, Liverpool playing there. And every time Liverpool crossed the halfway line, I braced myself in case they scored, because you could feel, you know, they're obviously in a big game like that, you know, with a lot of emotions running high. And sure enough, when Coutinho scored just before half time, I ducked down rather than jump up. And some guy came flying over the top of us. He was older than me. And he ended up at half time lying with his head facing down the steps between two blocks of seats. And the ambulance man had to come and deal with him. And, you know, when you get situations like that, that's not good. It's not good. And the best thing you can do is let people celebrate in a way that they're not going to hurt themselves and others.
Yes. So in a sense, like, it's an acknowledgement of the reality here. I mean, this isn't about encouraging a better atmosphere necessarily. Your point seems to be the scene you've just described is what's happening, so let's deal with it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think anyone who cares about football fans and anyone who's campaigned on behalf of football fans would say safety is the primary reason. Now, if it improves atmosphere, all well and good. And, you know, we know from almost every other walk of life, when people sing, they stand up. You know, it's the best way to do it. So, and they do anyway at football matches. Mm. So that'll be a side effect. It probably will improve the atmosphere. But the main thing is people, and you know what? It might be a majority of people only have cuts and bruises on the shins and things like that. And it may be, but, you know, they can at least go home without that sort of thing.
What percentage of, say, Premier League stadiums do you envisage having standing areas?
Well, in the short term, there'll probably be five or six that will do it, because you've got to have it in both ends. For example, Liverpool haven't got it at both ends at the moment. And obviously, Liverpool will probably be one of the last to do it. But for example, you know, Manchester United, Chelsea, Tottenham undoubtedly going to do it. So I think we'll see. You know, we'll see, as I say, five or six, a quarter of them doing it. But within the next two or three years, the entire Premier League and the entire Championship will probably have standing sections.
And Tony, how big do you think those standing sections will be in percentage terms of a ground's capacity?
Well, initially, they'll be small. But I think they'll move to about 20, 30%, you know, by the time we've finished it. I mean, remember, probably most people who go to football matches, and given the average age seems to be climbing and the prices seem to be excluding young people, most people who want to go to football matches are like me and want to sit down. They've got bad knees. They stuck for too long in the youth. And, you know, they need a little bit of relaxation at times. So, you know, that's the thing. The other thing is, no one's going to be forcing standing on Premier League fans or Championship fans when they go to the ground. No, people, some of the opponents have acted like that, as if, oh, we're going to be made to stand. No, you're not. What's going to be for? It's going to be for the young people, behind goals most likely, the people who go on the away end, places where there is persistent standing anyway, and which makes stewarding difficult, it makes policing difficult. And so, I can't see it ever getting higher than about 30%.
Yeah, I would tend to agree. Because, I mean, already, I don't know what the debate is like over in the UK, kind of, interested, I guess that's my question, but you can already imagine the lines of argument and, well, look at Euro 2020 in the final there, and if we give football fans an inch, they'll take a mile, and it's going to be unruly and disorganised and it will get out of hand. Those arguments, I suspect, are there. I don't know how vociferous they are.
Well, yeah, they are there, and it does happen. I mean, and there are occasions at big games, I think many of us have been to them, where clearly there are more people in the area, the seating area, than actually allotted seats. People have got into the grounds, and like the final at Wembley this year. But the one thing that each individual space for rail seating allows you to know whose ticket is there, the same way as in seats, allows you to know whose ticket and trace them back. And presumably, for me, the big problem with events like Wembley is not as much the configuration of the stadium, and it's the way football is policed. Football is still policed really badly. Some of the lessons from Hillsborough have not been learned yet. And the thing is, it's because they've never been truly addressed, and no one's ever taken responsibility, and no one ever will. And until we actually address the issues of the way you police football grounds, then what we'll have incidents like Wembley occasionally, and whether you've got safe standing or whether you've got seats, these things will happen.
Yeah, well, I guess ultimately, if you're letting too many fans into a ground, whether they're standing or sitting, I mean, that's beside the point. Your initial problem is the obvious one. I guess, look, a lot of people listening over here wouldn't necessarily be going to games all that often, if at all. What lessons have not been learned from Hillsborough when you talk about policing there around games in 2021?
Well, you know, you even look at this season. A lot of the teams in the Premier League, including Liverpool, have introduced computerized turnstiles where you can get in. You can use your phone in. That's the positive thing. You go, oh, this is great. Just got my phone and my ticket. Actually, there's massive queues being outside stadiums. Manchester City in the EFL Cup last night. There's massive queues outside before kickoff. People were not getting in time, and you're getting the old line thrown back at us as well. Oh, it's not a case of the system working. It's a case of people getting there late. Well, people have bought tickets. They should be allowed to get there as long as it's before the kickoff. At any time, the place should be set up to get them in. And that's just in terms of individual clubs doing this. In terms of policing stadiums, we saw at Wembley, they don't, the police don't set up their cordons at a good distance. They don't break up potentially rowdy incidents quickly enough. They let things slide. You look at Wembley, and that was almost, in many ways, although I think the parallels with Hillsborough are unfortunate, but outside the ground, it was a similar situation. What they didn't do was set up cordons to funnel people through, to make sure that you own the tickets, to slow down the crush at outside the ground, which in Hillsborough's instance led to the deaths and led to a policeman panicking and opening the gates. But Wembley, it allowed people who didn't have tickets to get in positions where they could charge the gates. And we consistently see this happening. And it's almost like nobody sat down and learned from it. And again, as I said before, and that's probably because no one's taken responsibility, because responsibility leads to people acting differently in the future.
Tony Evans from the London Independent. Always great to have you on, Tony. Thanks so much.
Always a pleasure.
The Football Show on Off the Ball.
I'm prepared to anything I can.
Well, do it then.
Come see again.
Do it then. What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it?
Why should an honest answer be a mistake?
How can a modern day manager not have a mobile phone?
Why should he?
Say, listeners, I'm spooked. This is the first time I've done a football show with the guest in studio since, well, you know yourself. Dan McDonald, how are you doing?
Hey, Joe, how are things?
Good. It's nice to have you in.
Yeah, I did have this exact chat with Nathan last week. So I don't have the same one where we sort of go through the, how long is it since I've seen you? Is it in
well,
the
we, well, we were having that chat during news, and then I don't want to get too personal here. I don't know, can I say?
Oh, you can, yeah.
Okay, so we just realised that me and my wife bumped into, I mean, listeners, I would say he was a mixture of shell-shocked and also smitten. outside well-known establishment. You weren't drinking, by the way, Hazel.
Just to be clear. it was November. I can tell you it was a lockdown. The pubs were not open at the time.
After, your firstborn was born. I mean, was it that day?
Day before, I think it was, yeah. I think that was the last time I saw you. I mean,
you did seem lost. We both commented on afterwards. It's like, should we? Does he know where he's going?
Yeah, I was sort of wondering. I was like, is this actually happened? Or what does this involve? And I was like, I mean, this photo I'm going around showing to random bystanders. At least I know this bystander. Yeah. You know, but yeah, it is actually that long ago. It's a classic one. Yeah, because we don't. Yeah. We did talk about catching up at one stage, but it's one of these Irish things where it's like, particularly during the whole COVID, like, let's try and catch up. Yeah, well, you know, we'll catch up. And it's just like, you know, I think it just becomes a lot of effort to like to do anything. Like it was, you know, in that phase of like the first couple of months of the year, even when you could go and meet people for a walk, say, you know, or get a takeaway outdoor coffee or outdoor something. And listen, I did it with a couple of people, but it is one of those things that you have great intentions, but then you just get into your habits, don't you?
Don't take it the wrong way. I never felt a great need to catch up with you because we were talking a lot anyway.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, I would have liked to see how you were getting on with your life.
But we were texting.
Put this right on air. That's fine. Like,
I don't just mean we were talking on the air. I mean, like, there was private correspondence as well. I knew what was going on.
But this is it. You know, you just have to realize, sometimes you have to catch up with people face to face as well. This is the best 2-minute opening to a football show we've had in months.
I had nothing more to say to you beyond what was in my text message.
I just see Aaron Connolly has scored twice tonight, by the way. Completely missed. That's something that's completely taken me by surprise. Just before we went on, I was like, well, check, because I know we're going to talk about some of the young Irish guns, and I was actually looking to see if Evan Ferguson was involved, who we were talking about recently, the 16-year-old, who I see hasn't made the bench. And James Furlong, a young Irish cadet, but Aaron Connolly has started and scored twice. And I'm telling you, like, Aaron Connolly has not scored many goals in the last 18 months.
Well, that's the first time he's certainly scored twice since that Spurs game when he was.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. No, he's got. I like, you know, since then, I think he might have got another one at the end of that season. And maybe, yeah, I vaguely recall one towards the end of last season, you know. But yeah, it's a big night for him. I mean, he's such a confidence sort of, you know, type of player.
Yeah.
But anyway, sorry, I sort of gone on a slight tangent there, but it's something we were thinning the ground in Irish stories tonight. There was quite a couple maybe last night that we'll speak about. But Aaron Connolly has just gone and delivered one there. Yeah.
That is welcome news. I mean, if Aaron Connolly found some form, that would change things.
Well, I mean, Aaron Connolly is going to be a big talking point, I think, in the next while around sort of Stephen Kenny's era, because I think he's shown faith in Aaron Connolly, which others would perhaps question, you know, because he didn't look particularly fit, I have to say, in the last window, or confident. But clearly, if he's playing and scoring twice, you know, in a cup game against, okay, Swansea, I mean, they're a decent championship side, that's got to do something for both of those things, you know, fitness and confidence. So it's interesting. There's a player in Aaron Connolly. It's just it's getting that out of him has proved quite difficult for people. I mean, the thing against Spurs, I mean, it wasn't a fluke. Like, you can see he's got ability, and even in the games most recently, you could see glimpses, but he didn't look to have the actual explosiveness to maybe execute some of the things he wanted to do. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see what type of goals they were and what it means for him going forward.
Manchester United still 1-0 down at home to West Ham, 64 minutes on the clock. Chelsea have taken a one-goal lead against Aston Villa. That had been nil-all for a long time. Arsenal 1-0 up at home to AFC Wimbledon. We have Leicester City away to Millwall. They're also leading there 1-0 up. And Wolves against Spurs looks like it's been a decent game. It's 2-2 between Wolves and Spurs again, 63 minutes on the clock. We'll be, quite a few things to get through this evening. We'll be talking to Jonty Coleman, who's a Portsmouth correspondent, about Gavin Bazunu. Just get a sense of how Bazunu has been playing week to week. Seems like he's done incredibly well at club level. And I guess Quevin Keller is responding every chance he gets.
Yeah, well, this was last night's sort of Irish overseas story of note, was probably Kelleher saving the penalty, all right, for Liverpool against Norwich. I mean, yeah, like it is sort of, I mean, I've said it before, like, how many discussions are people going to have about Bazunu and Kelleher in the next number of years? Like, lots, you know, like a serious sort of recurring theme where it does appear that and as much as there's always cautionary notes with these things, that, you know, Ireland do have two exceptionally good goalkeepers coming through. And Mark Travers, I must say, has actually got back into the Bournemouth side and is having a good season as well. Mm-hmm. And at another time, we'd probably be pretty happy with an Irish keeper, you know, starting for a good championship club. But these two, I mean, where they can go is you know, hyperbole is dangerous in this game, but I don't feel like it's misplaced with these.
Who do you suspect is going to win the war?
It's a good question. It's a good question. I think there's actually, there's two different backgrounds here in different ways. I mean, like Kelleher went to Liverpool early, you know, and has, looks to have everything, you know, and looks to tick a lot of the boxes. But what he doesn't have is, we don't have the experience of seeing how a run of games, what it can do for him. Whereas Bazunu, it just seems like he's growing every time you watch. But Kelleher seems like he's been very good all along, at a certain level. But we haven't necessarily seen a massive evolution in him, because what we've seen of him was quite sparing. Whereas Bazunu seems like he just gets dropped into another challenge and he seems to embrace it. And certainly, like at the start of the year, if you say, if you put that question to me, or like, forget me, like if you put that question to say someone around the Irish camp, you know, the Kelleher was very much ahead of Bazunu. Like, you know, like Bazunu, like at under 17 level for Ireland, he wasn't necessarily a starter, for example. Whereas, you know, Kelleher's been tipped the whole way up. But by all accounts, when Bazunu came into the Ireland squad in March, when Kelleher was injured and not there, he just wowed everyone. And we can see it now. He's just wowing people. He's winning a fan club with every game he plays. We'll speak to the Portsmouth correspondent later, where he seems to have done exceptionally well.
I think he's a lot of people's favourite Irish player at the moment.
I know, yeah, I know. He's the developing this, and he's a very impressive fella as well, you know, and that does count for something, you know. But I think, in fairness, there's no quibbles about Kelleher on that front either. That's why it's a tough one. Like, it's really, really difficult. Anyone who says with certainty they know, you know, I doubt where their certainty comes from on it. But like, there really is split opinions. And as I said, I'd speak to people who have been involved and around the camp, and, you know, people in the coaching capacity and stuff. And their opinion almost seems to change as it goes on, you know. And I think Bazunu is the one that's probably, he's surprised people more. But then if you speak to people who've worked with him for a long time, say some of the people at Shamrock Rovers, okay, they're always inclined to speak more favourably about their guy, in the way that maybe some people from Cork might speak more favourably about Kelleher. But people who know the character have always said this kid will go all the way, because they know what they're dealing with there, you know. And Rovers have done quite well at Bazunu, of course, as well. It's proved to be a very shrewd sale.
Not to go for too neat a segue, but another player at the World at his feet was Phil Jones. Did a really interesting interview in the Sunday Times at the weekend. I wanted to get your thoughts on. In effect, this was Jones actually fighting back after Rio Ferdinand's comments on Rio Ferdinand's podcast.
I'm
sure it's not too controversial thing to say that I'm sure Rio Ferdinand wants to make headlines with his podcast, you know. All publicity is good publicity. Boy, did he. I mean, he went for Jones in a big way. He was saying, I want to get the word incorrect. Yes, waste of time.
Yeah, it's a strong word.
Waste of time, who's taking up a youth player's position. I don't know who this great youth player is that Ferdinand's talking about, but he called Phil Jones a waste of time. And so Jones wanted to come out and do an interview, and he sat down with Jonathan Northcroft, and he said, listen, I've huge respect for Ferdinand, shared a dressing room with him, great professional, loved playing with him, great lad, good humour, I learned so much off him. But what he said was poor, it was really poor. I'm not into disputes, I'm not into arguments, and if he didn't know, he didn't know, .. And I guess that's the point of this interview. What we suspect Rio Ferdinand didn't know is that Phil Jones's knee has been a horror show actually all the way through. And I didn't fully appreciate this. I know he'd been out for the last maybe 18 months, but it seems even from when he was very early 20s, he was in serious trouble. He had to have the meniscus removed from his knee. It just wasn't repairable, apparently. So that left Jones for pretty much all his career, all his Manchester United career, with bone crunching against bone inside the joint. So apparently linear movement was okay, but anything sideways, which I'm sure is a pretty healthy proportion of your movement on a football pitch, anything sideways caused pain. So we're talking cocktail of anti-inflammatories and painkillers. And he said, you'd lay the ball off and any resistance against the knee was just agony, the merest nudge. For years, I'd go into games thinking I shouldn't really be playing. And it's been horrific. The headline is, I lost my mind, I thought I was finished. And that was when he was talking about after, you know, towards beginnings of lockdown, he felt he was in the best shape he'd ever been as a footballer. He'd had some work done and he'd had a chance to rest, and came back to the training session and it blew up straight away again on him, and he just walked off in disgust, walked straight off the training pitch, and he said, "It's the lowest I've ever been as a human being. My head was a mess. I'd be in tears. I'd say to Kaya," that's his partner, "I don't know what to do. I remember both of us crying." Long story short, he has gone for what seems like last resort surgery. And after 14 months of very lonely graft, I suspect, he was able to start United's pre-season training in July. Now, typical of his bad luck, he got COVID, but he's come back since then. Completed his first full training session August 2nd. Got a round of applause from teammates. You suspect they wouldn't applaud someone who they thought was taking the mick, I think. And he has since completed 2 90-minute appearances for the United under-23s. And the good news is, he says, "My knee feels incredible. It feels like I've started my career again. I feel young. I don't feel like I'm 29. I feel like I'm 25 or 26 because I've missed so much football." And he's hopeful. And his contract runs out in 2023. And I guess as he was coming back after the horrors, he hears Rio saying, "This guy's a waste of time." And so,
yeah,
I'm not surprised.
It's strange, because like Rio wasn't Rio, like you know, in the course of the Ronaldo thing, you know, he got the sense he's a mover and shaker. So
now Rio's given everyone that sense.
Well, I mean, absolutely, and I mean, I wouldn't be a massive fan, but I'm just saying, like, it was a strong thing to say for someone who's generally more uber positive about, say, the English players, if you know what I mean. It's almost like the type of thing, maybe that's almost the jarring aspect of it. It's the type of thing you would expect to hear said about maybe some foreigner, you know, in that position, you know, in that way. So it almost made you think, wow, like what it does make you think, God, is that what people are saying? Is that the view around the club?
Or even struck me, if, you know, he's able to spend 14 hours on the phone to Ronaldo or whatever the latest version of that is. He was in a dressing room with Phil Jones for 5 years. Drop him a text and say, "I noticed you've been injured for 18 months. What's the story?
What's going on?" Yeah.
That was
a fair point. And when you mentioned we might talk about this, like, I sort of went looking around to see was there any more, and I see Jones done an interview on the club podcast. Right. And again, listen, I mean, we work in it. You know, you see that Jonathan Norcroft piece, and you could say, well, listen, this is something that they've decided to do, and it's a very favourable presentation of the discussion. But obviously you can pick up sometimes more by maybe watching, and it was actually sort of a YouTube clip, I saw a 5-minute clip of the listening to the person talking to get a sense, is this someone, as you know, you do these interviews where someone has their head down and they're clearly sort of throwing out the jargon. And no, and again, like, also, I mean, someone could just be very polished as well too, but it did seem quite sincere, you know, and that clearly the fact he was doing this as well, there's probably been some kind of attempt maybe from his camp, all right, to say, well, you need to get out there and get ahead of this, you know, to avoid this perception from being planted. But it did come across quite well, you know, that it did sort of, you know, something that had been sort of hurting him, that, you know, he's going home to his, you know, to his kids, you know, and he doesn't necessarily just start putting words in his mouth, but sort of paraphrasing what he was saying. But like, obviously that lack of sense of purpose or whatever, that lack of involvement. And I know some people will hear this story and go, how much money has he collected over the last number of years? I mean, it is true. Like, he's on a very good contract. Even the fact that he's up to the end of 2023.
He says that himself.
Yeah.
Like, he does acknowledge it's a first world problem. But
it
it's
is
still a problem for him.
It is. No, but I mean, as you know, like, he referenced during lockdown, and I suppose no matter anyone's situation, you know, I don't know, was it a period of reevaluation for a lot of people in many ways? And yes, I mean, he has his money, and that's absolutely tremendous for him and his, you know, security for life and beyond. But I mean, at the same time, if you're sort of becoming a small bit of a punch bag or even a punchline, and you've got, you know, it's not as if you can go off on holidays and get away from it for a month, you know, and get away from the world. You know, it's almost a time where it's, he spoke about maybe getting fit during lockdown, having that focus, and here we go. And then having the setback and being told you're a waste of time. Like, you know, footballers are still going to evaluate themselves against what's around them and their world and the standards of their world. And no matter how much cash he has in years to come, Phil Jones will be spoken of as what could have been. Now, he still hopefully has time to change that, and it would be a great story if he came back, but clearly there's been an attempt from their side that they need to maybe go out and portray. Like I can imagine, like someone like that, when they're out of sight, they're not put forward for media. They're not accessible for media requests. You know, they're not being talked about, and it's easy for perception to be cemented. So, but I have to say, yeah, I mean, he did come across quite well. I have to thought in both those pieces.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He mentions just one little anecdote. There's a little like sidebar, and it's a welcome lift from Fergie. And so he's recalling Alex Ferguson. This was at Ferguson's documentary, the premiere of his documentary. And he went along with a couple of the players and quick shakes of hands and everything. And then he says, out of the blue, Ferguson, completely out of the blue, says, "Hey, you were effing terrific against Real Madrid in 2013. Effing Mark and Ronaldo." And then walked off. And Jones, it gave me so much confidence. I don't even remember watching his premiere. I was just sitting there thinking about his comment, thinking he remembers it. Someone of that magnitude remembers it. And Ferguson, there's good, there's bad, there's wonderful with Ferguson, but I'm sure he sensed this guy was in the horrors, and a pick-me-up like that clearly registered.
Ferguson has the power of knowing that one comment from him carries a lot more weight. The fact even he headed off afterwards, he didn't then hang around and go, "And by the way, how the family doing?
My work here is done."
Yeah, it's like, I've dropped my sort of my very brief TED talk here with you, and I'm gone off. There's something poignant about that as well,
there
too,
is
of course.
Something lovely about it. I'd say it's a performance that Jones remembers. You know, if that was you and you marked Ronaldo and you were really good against Real Madrid away, like, you'd remember that and cherish it. And so I suspect for a Ferguson to come up and go, "By the way, I remember that too. We both know how good that was."
Yeah, you were there. Yeah, you did it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it makes you more, like, it makes you, I don't know, when he does come back, or wherever he does come back, it probably does make you more inclined to be invested in him doing well.
He had the great misfortune in the internet age to pull very expressive faces when things were going badly around him.
Yeah.
And so his head would often pop up on like memes or gifs of things going wrong for someone, like dropping drinks, but it's Phil Jones's head there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just
the cruelty of
some
the internet.
People, think of all the people who did stupid expressions back in a different time. We never had the pleasure of becoming a viral sensation in the worst way.
We had Tony Evans on in the first hour. I suspect if you're listening on podcast, you would have heard the piece. Very interesting chat. So it seems that standing, safe standing, that's very much of their billing, it, safe standing, not just standing, is going to be back in the Premier League from January 1st. It's licensed. It'll be at a number of grounds. They have to apply. In effect, they've trialled this mechanism or this particular version of it in various stadiums, including Celtic Park and Borussia Dortmund. And I think Shrewsbury as well was mentioned. It's not that complicated. The seat that you would be sitting on is bolted up, and you have a railing in front of you and a railing behind you. It stops, obviously, you know, because we've seen standing at the moment, which isn't meant to be happening, and you see the celebrations and people are falling down, you know, a row or two in front of them. And so it's that simple. You still would have your ticket. You'd still have your location that you're meant to be in. The capacity isn't going to jump. So it's not like, oh, we'll get an extra 10,000 into that standing section. And in the main, the consensus seems to be, this is a good move because it's happening anyway. And Tony Evans was making the point that Merseyside in the last decade has come around to the notion as well in the main.
Yeah, I mean, they're the key points that you make. I mean, the worst pictures you see of days gone by, and you go beyond, like, I mean, Hillsborough and all that, you know, speaks for itself, of course. But, I mean, and there was reasons for that you know, the operation of the day and so on. But clearly, like, you watch footage of the English grounds in the 80s and you can see accidents waiting to happen.
Or,
and the overcrowding. And also as well, I mean, you know, football fans, I'm sure, you know, would have been touched on. Like, they were also, like, treated like animals as well, too. You know, so, like, that was the thing. I mean, the caging, the all the sort of way in which they were treated, unfortunately, invited maybe scenes. I mean, like, you would see it here. I mean, the capacity of Daily Mount Park used to be, you know, sort of
100,000.
Well, not quite, but, you know, you see some of the famous Ireland games, and they play their 70s, 80s, and people on the roof and in all sorts of positions, and really people would say it's a miracle that nothing serious ever actually happened. And even in some of the grounds here at the moment, like, they've had to, like, where standing, of course, is still possible in many places, but with fire safety limits and stuff, the capacities are way reduced compared to what it was. So, yeah, like, I don't think really any of the issues that happened in the past, the issue was standing. The issue was access, numbers that were permitted to access, security and operations. And if you can manage all of those things, well, then there shouldn't really be an issue, you know. And as you say, like, you see people who go to games now, and like, a lot of people stand through games, as you know, as people who go to games, wherever they go to games, would know. Like, and in fact, someone standing up in front of you, you know, can be a source of annoyance for people. But now, at least people who are determined to do that have a place to go. I think it's pretty logical, really, when you put it that way.
I think so. It was just so emotive for so long.
No, I understand it. But of course, like, again, it was about what caused that. You know, was it just because they were standing? Clearly, you know, something needed to be done at the time, you know, and there was an emotive aspect to it. But again, you know, Hillsborough, those things didn't happen just because people were standing. They happened because of, you know, how people were probably treated.
Yeah. We'll mention Joe Kinnear in a moment. But first, just... Ronald Koeman's financial arrangement, I was reading about that briefly before coming in air. It's quite staggering. So things not going well at Barcelona on various fronts, as we know, and Koeman's working with, fairly average Barcelona side, a lot of kids in the side. Juan Laporta came in March, decided pretty early on Koeman's not his man. Juan Laporta, obviously their great president and, you know, spearheaded a lot of the success. And then Bartomeu's came in subsequently and things not good. So Koeman not his man. 6 months later, he thought, maybe, and now he's gone right off Koeman again. So it seems that the Koeman contract, it struck me as like an FAI type deal, as in, let's let future FAI worry about this.
This is, okay, do you want to go through some of the deal? Because you sent this to me and I was like, I sort of had to reread some of these paragraphs to double check I was reading the right thing.
Yeah, so Koeman was Dutch manager when Barcelona wanted him. Now, the Dutch were looking for 6 million to release Koeman from his contract. Barcelona didn't want to pay that, certainly not at the time. So Koeman, out of his own pocket, paid the 6 million. Nice to have that kind of cash.
I mean, that's a good power to have. There's a lot of people out there thinking, listen, Barca, I'll give you 10. I'll do it.
It was 600 euro, I think, twice about buying myself out of the contract. So 6 million paid up courtesy of Mr. Orr Koeman in August 2020. However, Barcelona agreed, this is the FAI, you know, we'll worry about it later on part, that he would be reimbursed to the full amount if he doesn't get a third year at the club. So Koeman was smart enough to say, I'll pay you the 6 million, but if I don't get 3 years with you guys, you're paying that 6 million whenever you choose to.
He was loaning the 6 million, but really sort of...
Sense. Yeah. So if he doesn't get the 3 years, let alone where he is now, if he doesn't get the 3 years, then he's getting that 6 million back. If they choose to fire him in the meantime, which is what they kind of want to do, then they have to give him 12 million. So again, he had everything, negotiated.
But he sits back 12. That evening, you know, people have, you know, taken new jobs, new situations, and you ponder over it. I'm sure when he's sitting there, and people are probably, maybe doing interviews going, was it very hard for you to leave the Dutch national team? Which I'm sure on one hand it was, but on the other hand, he possibly wanted to say, well, I mean, it is, but you should see this deal I've done.
Well, I can just
imagine. This deal I've done is absolutely...
Laporta arriving at the club, various bits, Koeman's not his man, he's like, okay, I'll sack him in a few months, these things happen. And at some stage, someone said, Juan, you should just have a look at Ronald's contract here. And he opened it. I'd say the amount of times he has cursed Bartomeu is off the charts. So if he wants to get rid of Koeman, he's going to have to pay up 12 million. Now, Dan, I don't know if you know this. They don't have 12 million.
It does appear to be an issue for them at the moment.
Maybe they could get a loan from Ronald Koeman.
Yeah. Yeah. So. And I mean, but some of the further details in it, the extent to which Koeman's style of play is born out of a complete lack of faith in the team, that he effectively, some people, I'm sure it was discussed on the show, but like the Bayern Munich game, almost the sadness of it, in the sense that like they were so comprehensively beaten, but his approach was effectively damage limitation. Like that was the plan. Like when you have Barcelona going into a game, like, you know, if you hear Barcelona are playing a Champions League game at home, anyone who's been watching football over, you know, well, in particular the last 10-15 years, I know you can go back way further in time for times when they were top dogs too, it's sort of hard to get your head around how that could happen. But I mean, like, modern football is littered with so many tales of waste, and we sometimes think because people, you know, are administrators at the elite, the highest end of football, sometimes you can put people on a pedestal and assume that because they've ascended to that position that they have, you know, they have an ability that sits in alongside the status of the club or operation or organisation they're representing. And of course, it's just not true, because football is a crazy game, and something like that, I mean, it should be a warning sign, but it'll be someone else in years to come.
Joe Kinnear, desperately sad. Mm. So born in Dublin, Joe Kinnear, for younger listeners, 26 caps for the Republic of Ireland, manager, Wimbledon, obviously, and, you know, Premier League era right through to 08-09 with Newcastle. And he was director of football at Newcastle up until 2014. So it seems in 2015, he was diagnosed with vascular dementia. His condition has since deteriorated. His wife, Bonnie, did an interview in the Daily Telegraph today. She was recalling the time of the diagnosis. He started to get moody, a bit depressed. I thought, this isn't right. Then he got aggressive in certain situations. It just wasn't Joe. It was a problem trying to get him to see somebody, but we eventually got him to a doctor and he was diagnosed in 2015. They classed it as early onset vascular dementia. And then, it's terribly sad, she says, since then he's just deteriorated. He's in the late stage. And I guess we can draw our own conclusions there. It's heartbreaking to see how someone can change. And it's Joe Kinnear, I guess, figure, very real figure, very modern figure for lots of us watching Premier League football. And, you know, he was a relatively young man in 2015.
I mean, that's the striking thing about it, I think. And, this is obviously, I know there's obviously grades of dementia and Alzheimer's and different versions of neurological issues that sort of ex-players are suffering. And I think sometimes, as much as it's sort of, it's very shocking to discuss, some of the cases, the Jeff Astle case and stuff about the England Stars of 1966. I think sometimes for people of a generation that are covering it, they think, well, that's something that's in the distant past, and it's sad. But people almost, I don't know, there's a sense of, well, that's something from a long time. And it's these cases where it's someone who's been part of the news cycle very recently, whose utterings, to be fair, in press conferences and stuff, would have been mocked at times, and certainly, we just can't go down the road of diagnosing, well, maybe this was the reason this happened at that time. But, clearly, he's suffered issues of some description.
Yeah.
And it's sore. It is particularly jarring when it's someone. And I mean, there was the Terry McDermott one recently as well. Kevin Keegan's assistant, and the sort of, to a lot of younger people, that's who he is. To most other people, he's the Liverpool legend,
yeah,
one of the great players. But when it's someone who you can picture them in very recent times engaged in football, I think it's even more striking, And this broader issue is not going away. And more people, unfortunately, speaking out, such as his wife, and sort of telling the stories, it just makes it even more real. Mm-hmm. And we sort of see where this broader debate and discussion goes. Again, not to diagnose the reason it happened was because of heading or something, that can be very simplistic. But you see there's a trial game at the moment being planned in England where no heading will take part.
So this is
basically a trial as it is, and they're looking to organise a game. I think it's with ex-players or various people. I just need to be 100% right in the details of it. But I mean, we've seen that at underage level in America, heading has been taken out of the equation. And part of me would think, they'll never take heading out of the game. And I probably do still ultimately believe that. But then the more and more stories you hear where it becomes more recent,
yeah,
to people, and you can see this drive and this discussion continuing.
Keep coming, because you see that it's been effectively proven. University of Glasgow,
yeah,
study, you can search it, and footballers are 6 times more likely than the general population to be diagnosed with some form of dementia. So because someone could listen to this and say, well, look, it's very sad, Joe Kinnear, but people in the general population are diagnosed
all the time. I'm wary of diagnosing him. Obviously the issue.
But the bottom line is, footballers are 6 times more likely,
yes,
and it's linked to heading, it would seem. So Joe Kinnear or not, this issue is still there, and the heading issue is still there. But certainly, as the big names keep coming now over the coming years.
Yeah, no, it is. I think it's just something impactful about it, because, again, he was a pundit on Irish TV screens for so long as well. Yeah. You forget, in the 90s, he was a sort of a big voice around Ireland games and stuff like that. So, big character, big personality. So, yeah, really sad.
Football on Off the Ball.